You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Curtain up, theater people, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket. Coming to you from the Hell's Kitchen area of Midtown Manhattan, right in the middle of Broadway. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. Your Program Is Your Ticket is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. As many of you know, Your Program Is Your Ticket is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater and smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on the show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. I love theater and see as much as I can wherever I go. During the travels of the production of my husband and my play At the Flash, I've met many wonderful people from all over the world in the theater community, and it is my honor to bring them on as guests to the show. Tonight's guests are composer David Kornfeld and lyricist Alex Higgin-Hauser. The music writing team of CPA Theatrical's musical Numbers Nerds, about an almost all-girl high school math team chosen to compete in the National Math Summit, SUM-IT, who unite to solve difficult math problems, conquer anxiety and rivalry, and find a way to affirm themselves as individuals and as team members. I love that. That sounds so inspiring and fun. It's currently featured, and it's going to have its opening night tonight, in this year's 2017 New York Musical Festival, a.k.a. NYMPH. Now, I'm going to say that quite a few times because some people get a little confused about what NYMPH means, and I've been trying to clear it up all over the city of New York. So there we go. Anyways, also in the audience tonight, we have an honorary audience member. That's what we're referring to her as, and her name is Laura Stratford, and I've previously interviewed her, and she is the book writer for Numbers Nerds. So, hi, Laura.
Hi.
Okay, there she is. Now, I'm going to let the guys say hi in just a second. But first, I would like to go over a little history about the New York Musical Festival, or NYMPH. Okay, so here we go. The New York Musical Festival, NYMPH, is an annual three-week summer festival which presents more than 30 new musicals at venues in New York City's Midtown Theater District. As of 2015, the festival has premiered over 375 musicals. Wow. And have featured the work of over 8,000 artists. That's crazy. And attended by 300,000 theater goers. So it's a wonderful festival, and it gives so many terrific opportunities. In addition to full productions, NYMPH presents a wide range of special events, readings and concerts of new music, educational seminars, explorations of musicals in TV and film, and unusual collaborations with the New York-based art organizations. As of 2008, the musical Title of Show became the first show to transfer from the New York Musical Theater Festival to a commercial Broadway production. And then in 2009, Next to Normal, which is a huge show, and I believe they just did it in Chicago, where I believe one of these guys is from, if I did my research correctly. Anyways, Next to Normal became the second show to transfer from the New York Musical Theater Festival to a commercial Broadway production. It won 3 Tony Awards, including Best Score and Best Leading Actress in a Musical for Alice Ripley. Next to Normal went on to win the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. So that's cool. Pulitzer Prizes are cool. Excellent. On September 10th, 2012, Chaplin became the third musical to transfer from NYMPH to the commercial Broadway stage. It starred Rob McClure, an excellent actor. I didn't see him in Chaplin, but I saw him in Honeymoon in Vegas. He's terrific. And he received a Tony nomination for Best Leading Actor in a Musical. And then just most recently, In Transit, which I believe had an off-Broadway run, and then in 2016, transferred to the Circle in the Square Theater. So that's very cool. Other productions that have run off-Broadway are Altar Boys, which ran from 2005 to 2010. Great show. Again, done all over the United States and maybe the world. I don't know. You know, be possible. Yank, which had a run in 2010. Fat Camp, which had a run in 2012 and 2015. I believe they changed the name of it to Gigantic the Musical. I saw it and I loved it. That was one of my favorite shows of 2015. I just thought it was terrific. And then Clinton the Musical, which I wanted to mention because, you know, we're all things political these days, at the New World Stages in 2015. That was really funny. I love that show. Also, NYMPH gives out awards for excellence, which, I don't know, may have my guests on pins and needles a little bit, but who knows? We'll see. Can't think about awards. You just have to think about doing it really well. But anyways, I'm going to talk about them. They have Best of Fest, the Audience Prize, Most Promising New Musical, Theater for an American Musical Prize, and Excellence in Writing Music, Excellence in Writing Lyrics, Excellence in Writing Book, Excellence in Direction, Excellence in Choreography, Excellence in Overall Design, Outstanding Orchestrations, pardon me, and an Outstanding Ensemble Performance. That's great. They give an Ensemble Performance Award, so that's really cool. So there we go. Now, I'm going to say this. I myself didn't see any of the shows that won any of the awards, and I saw like 8 shows, and I love pretty much all of them. So I didn't see any award winners. I saw stuff that didn't win awards, and I thought that they were brilliant and wonderful. So take that for what it's worth, which is, in my opinion, worth a lot. So there you go. That's a little bit about NIMPH, and it is running right now, and you can go to nimph.org to get information and buy tickets. And I'm telling you, you have to buy tickets now because a lot of these shows sell out. I wanted to go to a couple of them, I think it was yesterday or the day before, and just completely sold out. So fortunately, I have my tickets for our guests' show. So let's bring them on. Please welcome Numbers Nerds composers David Kornfeld and lyricist Alex Higgin-Hauser. Hi, gentlemen, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Hi. I am saying your names correctly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Phew. All right. I practiced beforehand. Now, I was put together with you guys by the by CPA theatrical founder and CEO, producing artistic director Larry Little. He has a big title.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Wow. and so it's really cool that I'm interviewing a music team. I think it's wonderful. I don't think I've interviewed a music team yet. I've interviewed musicians, and I've interviewed music directors. So you guys are my first music team.
Awesome. We're excited to set the standard.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Don't put too much pressure on yourself, okay? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your creative theater passions.
David, you want to start?
Sure. Let's see. I really got into theater because of Alex. We started doing shows in college at Carleton College in Minnesota, and I just sort of on a whim joined the student musical theater club, and the show that they were doing was Rocky Horror Show, and they said, uh-huh, we need a music director. So I was like, well, I've never done that before, I'll do that. And Alex was directing, and we just had such a blast that we've been doing it ever since. And so, you know, I caught the bug.
That's true. Actually, right after that production, this is Alex talking, I had this idiot idea that I called him with, because we directed the show together and then were made the leaders of this student musicals organization because no one else wanted to do it. And so I called up David and said, hey, we should write a musical. And he's like, that is a terrible idea.
Oh my God.
We've never done this before. We should not do that.
And look at you now.
Right? We had this idea for a show called Math Major, the Musical, actually. So we started out this whole thing with math puns.
Yeah.
And it's fun to come, you know, to New York with math puns now. And then we started writing that show. We ran out of math puns after about one song called The Derivative of Love. And then we realized we needed to expand. So we actually brought in Laura Stratford, the honorary audience member of this recording today, who is our book writer and longtime collaborator, who was an English major. I'm biochem for undergrad, and David was music. And
so none of us theater majors.
Yeah, none of us theater majors, although we took as much coursework as we could.
Right.
But there wasn't really a point in majoring in theater in a small private liberal arts college.
It was all very, like, hands-on. You know, there was... They had a theater department, but they didn't do musicals. And so we were like, well, we like musicals, so we want to do it. We had to do everything ourselves, so we really had to learn sort of by doing, which was a, you know, very liberal artsy sort of experience.
Yeah, so we wrote our first show in a 10-week term and then performed it. And then we wrote another show called Grind, which we toured the Midwest with in 2010.
And then the first show, Math Major, the Musical, eventually became Liberal Arts, the Musical.
Yes, which we then restaged.
Which actually is
Chicago.
There's a recording of it on iTunes that you can get.
And on Spotify.
And on Spotify,
yes.
Which we did later, a couple years later when we did a remount in Chicago. We made a recording.
And then when we moved to Chicago, we realized, we arrived saying, like, hey, we're musical theater writers, produce our work. And we realized that no one touches new musicals in Chicago,
right.
So we decided to start our own company, which is called Underscore, which actually produces new musicals in Chicago.
That's great. So let me get this straight. The guy who is the music major was the one who was like, we shouldn't write a musical.
Yeah.
No.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I was like I said, that was my first experience just music directing, and I had played in bands, and like that was much more where my head was writing, you know, rock music and jazz and that kind of thing, and so I had never considered the idea of writing a musical before.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, him saying no was the right answer. Like,
why?
I'm not knocking him for it. Like, we had no idea what we were doing.
Oh my gosh.
And 99 times out of 100, that idea would have resulted in something just embarrassing. We lucked out that we had the right combination of people in the right place, and we were able to work together. And we had no way of anticipating how well we would work together.
Yeah.
And it was a really remarkable and delightful surprise that has led to now a collaboration that's lasted our entire careers.
Mm-hmm.
In the, you know, 10 years since college,
mm-hmm.
the amount of time we've spent together in the writing room, like, you know.
Yeah,
wow.
It really was an incredible just, like, sort of spark moment where, you know, I was like, no, you know. But then we started talking about this song and, like, you know, the lyrics...
Mm-hmm.
popped up in your head. You know, you sent me these lyrics, and I was like, I have a musical idea that works perfectly with that. And then, ding!
That's amazing.
And we also lucked out with having really good teachers at Carleton.
Yeah.
We brought in the executive producer of Desperate Housewives was a Carleton alum, so he came in and taught a workshop. Peter Gwynn, who was a writer for the Colbert Report, was also an alum, and he came in and talked about, like, a group writing session. We had Schadenfreude, which is a group from Second City, come out and also do a residency. City Company came out from New York. We had Looking Glass people in. We got to meet a lot of writers who come at things from a lot of different perspectives. And
sort of learn about that collaborative process.
Yeah, learn how to... They say kill your darlings. We say kill your babies. Just so we can be even more clear that these things are precious and dear to us.
and we have to
excise them.
Oh, I know. I know. It's really, really difficult when you're cutting stuff that you just absolutely love, but is not landing. It's like, it's just not working. I would say, I love it, but I wrote it.
Right.
So, you know, just because I wrote it doesn't mean it's good. Not saying that about you guys, obviously. Now,
I feel that.
No.
Yeah.
Now, I believe I didn't stalk you guys. I just wanted to sort of like find out about one of you lives in New York. That's you.
David.
Okay, that's David. Alex, you live in Chicago. And Laura, I know, lives in Chicago as well. So you're writing a musical with one of you in New York and two of you in Chicago. How does that work?
Well, when we first started out this project, it was in Chicago, so we were all together.
Mm-hmm.
So I only moved to New York actually just about a year ago.
Okay.
So throughout like the first several drafts of this show, we were able to do everything in the room together, which was great. And then when I moved to New York was when Larry brought on, just because I was going into school here at NYU for the Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I was going to be busy with school and everything, Larry brought on another composer, Dylan Marcorelli, who just to sort of like finish a lot of the edits and things that like needed to happen in the last few drafts. And,
yeah,
and
we had like
also
one or
really
two
directed.
Songs that we wanted to like, well, write, frankly.
we
hadn't done it, but like, we realized like, oh, there's the necessity of a song that does this. Well, so Dylan came in to help wrap up.
Now
he's
credited for writing additional music.
Exactly. Yeah.
Great.
And the heart of the music of the show was written by David.
Yeah, but Dylan's been fantastic, and I think that like his music really worked in the spirit of what we had set out to do also. So you know, I think it works really well. And
it's interesting too because we've had experiences where like. David tends to be the one who writes music, although Laura is very excellent at writing melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I dabble, but these guys are better. but we've had a lot of experience having like multiple lyricists or multiple book writers,
mm-hmm.
but never really multiple composers.
Yeah, yeah. So
which
it's interesting.
It is a different flavor of writing, and it's interesting. But I think where we landed with it is really exciting.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Now, I write with my musical writing partner, Leo Schwartz, and he lives in Chicago as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's awesome. Before I moved to New York, I lived in Los Angeles. So we were always doing our writing from, you know, thousands of miles away, we relied heavily on like instant messaging, email, Skype. Do you guys do that too?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We spend a lot of time on the Google product suite.
Right.
They're paying me a lot to endorse them right now. Right. So, but like we're on GChat, we do Google Hangouts, Google Docs. So you can see each other editing things, which is, all of those things are almost good tools.
Yeah. And we have been, still sort of getting used, since it's only been a year since I've been in the, out of Chicago, like we're still sort of getting used to the process of like the Skyping and getting used to, you know, schedules and time differences and everything. It's definitely a challenge.
Because David and I have another project that we collaborated on as well pretty recently called Haymarket, which was in Chicago this last spring.
Oh, yeah. God. Great reception.
Thank you. It had the best reception of anything we've ever done. We're like, yes!
Yeah.
Very excited. Yeah. So we are planning on doing a remount of that in the spring of next year.
Excellent.
And that's kind of on the DL, but I'm happy to say it.
Okay.
We have been working on that kind of long distance as well, and it is different.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It is.
Yeah. This is kind of fun, because then, like, David will send me an idea for something, and when you're not in the room with a composer who sends you musical ideas, it takes some unpacking. So I'll get a recording, they'll be like, all right, here's what I was thinking. I'll be like, oh, where were the syllables?
What is sitting like on his phone and it's like...
Yeah, exactly. And then I'll like call him on the phone, he'll explain it to me like, oh, duh, that makes total sense. But until then, it's this like series of rooting doo-doo-doos. Wait, how do I do this?
I'm going to take both of those sounds that you guys just did and make them my ringtone. I want to lift them from this and make them my ringtone.
We'd be on.
That would be $1 million.
Exactly. The royalty is
right?
Very affordable.
Let's talk about the process that you as a writing team and your producer CPA Theatricals and Larry Little undertook creating this particular show.
This was a really a new experience for us because it was being brought on to a project where the producer Larry had he had an idea for a show and he needed to bring in people to realize it. And,
yeah, he's credited for the story,
yeah,
I believe. Yeah, and obviously producing it as well.
Yeah, and the amount of time and energy and finances and wrangling that he has put into this process is Herculean. Like, it is incredibly impressive, and I don't know how he does it. He's a font of energy, which is truly incredible.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
But yeah, so he had this idea that we should create a show for the secondary education market primarily, but hopefully a show that could also live on its own. But like, high schools need shows to produce.
Right.
We don't need to see another high school production of Guys and Dolls. And the biggest problem for a lot of these high schools is they don't have roles for women. They don't have casts that can be like both small and large, depending on the drama department. And they don't have things that like resonate with things people are trying to push in education today, like STEM, which I prefer STEAM, where you stick arts in the middle of STEM.
Yes.
But
I'm not familiar with that. What is that?
STEM is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Okay.
As like a core group of subjects that you should push in education.
Gotcha.
Which, don't get me wrong, is incredibly important. Like I said, I'm a biochem major. Like, I deeply care about those things, but I want to put the arts right in the middle of that, because without that, what are we engineering for? But, you know, soapbox.
Yes.
That's okay.
But so Larry had, I think, what is a very keen business insight, as well as like just commercial producers' insight of a market that was not being served, and started generating some ideas for a show. And the nexus of all of those is this idea of a all girls or mostly all girls math team that wants to win the national competition and has a lot of things that stand in their way. And the story has evolved a lot as we all have been working together, but the core of what it is. And then he gave us this kind of show Bible of, like, here's some pretty detailed insights into some characters, and why don't you guys take this and see what sticks, see what doesn't, and let these ideas bloom in your own writing. And so we've never done anything like that before, which is, like, at first we're like, we should come up with every idea, and then we're like, this is nice that we don't have to come up with every idea. And we can just execute some ideas.
It gave a really, really great framework to work within and just inspire creativity.
Yeah, so he did a search for a composing team, and Laura, David, and I submitted. David keenly noticed the posting and was like, we should do this. And we were lucky enough to be selected. It was down to us and some other team from New York, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, and I still don't know who they were, but we did get to hear the song they submitted, and it was really good.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So we were like, oh, great, God, they're going to beat us.
Yeah.
But I think the song that we submitted ultimately as, like, the core of our submission to be considered for it, it was called Melissa's First Theorem, which is still in the show and is almost entirely unchanged. I added one half of a bridge to it, but this thing has been there since the very, very, very beginning, and it is the ultimate I want song in the show. I think it's the showstopper.
Yeah.
And Maisie, who performs it, knocks my ever-loving socks off.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like what you guys did with your piece, with your entry piece, was create a heart for the show.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's really, really important. I think people need to connect, and they need to feel while they're watching the show. And you guys understood that, and that's terrific. Speaking of things like that, are there any particular messages or themes that you two individually and together strive to feature in the works that you choose to write or produce or direct?
I mean, we always talk about trying to keep our characters at the tippy top of their intelligence, and having the characters surprise you with, like, how smart and how, like, aware of their world they are. Partly because I think having characters be dumb is disappointing for an audience member. You know, it's the old adage of, like, tell an audience 2 and 2 is 4, and they're not going to care. Give an audience 2 and 2, and let them make 4. They'll love you forever. Mm. I'm butchering that, but it's the idea behind it. That's something that we talk about a lot in the room.
I think creating. Maybe edit this part out.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Creating characters that are. That are something that have that heart and have, like, they're not just caricatures, and, like, you can use archetypes, but they have to be surprising in some way. And a lot of these characters that we have in this show, kind of, they have started from certain types, sort of archetypes, but we put them in different situation that you might not see normally, and they are surprising in their way. Like, there's a character in Numbers Nerds who you might think at first is, like, sort of ditzy, stupid character, but she surprises you with other aspects of herself.
Mm-hmm. And there's different kinds of intelligence. It's something that so in my other life, when I am not writing with these guys, I'm working with these guys to run Underscore Theater Company, where we are invited to see a lot of readings of a lot of new musicals.
Sure.
In the last week, I've been to 3.
Wow.
In Chicago. And I have 20 in my inbox right now. They still need to go through that are from the last 3 months alone.
In addition to putting on a show in New York with Nip, okay.
That's the one. And having directed a show, we do a lot in the new musical realm. Mm-hmm. And the thing that is most often missing is a sense of truth in the story. Mm-hmm. So all of the characters who are on stage, like, if they have a name, they have to want something. That's a simple thing to say, but it's so absent from so many shows. And, like, but give them something to want and put something in their way, and all of a sudden people really care, because we empathize with that. You know, everyone's got a different struggle, but you see someone trying to overcome theirs, and you find something that's analogous to your own. And, you know, early on in the Numbers Nerds process, we were talking about, like, what do we do to, like, raise the stakes, you know what I mean?
Sure,
of, like, should there be, like, a life and death situation where people are in genuine mortal danger, or should there be, like, a, you know, should we go to, like, 13 Reasons Why territory, you know, that sort of thing, because it is high school. But the conclusion we came to as a group was that, like, A, in high school, every moment feels like it is a life or death moment
because
the stakes are so high, or the tensions are so high because the stakes are so low.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much agitas, you know, happening in every day-to-day situation that, like, letting the characters really live in that kind of world and taking whatever they stakes they experience and then, you know, turning those up to 11, then we have drama. It was, I think, a really important realization for us as we were writing the show. Like, we don't need to have, you know, like, a hostage situation or something for people to be like, what's going to happen? Whether or not they're going to win the math competition, that kind of matters. Whether or not one character is going to choke or not, that matters.
And just, like, one character's feelings about, like, how the other characters feel about them really matter.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, in a place like a high school, you know.
Yeah, everything is amplified to the nth degree when people are going through adolescence and developing and that. What were some of the writing challenges that you guys encountered writing Number Nerds with mostly women in the cast? Now, there is one male character, but the rest are female, right?
You know, I think an important insight we had really early in our writing was we were like, I was in a playwriting class, and someone asked the question of, like, how do you write women characters? And the professor, like, it was Barb Field, who is the resident playwright at the Guthrie and is a delightful, sardonic genius who brokers no nonsense. She, like, just set down her pencil. She's like, well, the trick is you write people, and then you tell them what genitals they are later. And that's something that I think we've kind of just held on to pretty intuitively. Like, the struggles these characters face are not, like, or at least by and large, not, like, stereotypical female character struggles in, like, kind of hack drama. Like, what will boys think of me? And, you know, basically repeatedly failing the Bechdel test. This is a show that passes the ever-loving hell out of the Bechdel test. You know?
Tell us what the Bechdel test is. I know what it is, but a lot of my listeners don't.
Alison Bechdel, whose life story inspired the wonderful show Fun Home, is a gender studies theorist and wonderful academic who proposed a very simple test. She actually proposes kind of as a joke, but it is caught on. She proposed it in a comic strip, actually, very originally. And the test was, does your show feature two women that have a conversation with each other in which they do not discuss a man? And that's it.
And surprisingly, few things pass that test.
Yeah,
sure.
It's a really low bar, but it's not that hard. But it seems to be really hard because many stories center around, like, just, you know, what used to be the default in storytelling of, like, straight white male. That, thank God, is becoming less the default in storytelling because there's enough of my people have been written about.
I think we wouldn't have presumed to write a show about the experience of being of a number of girls in high school without having a female book writer. And so, like, having Laura, I mean, despite it being true what Alex said, like, you just write characters, just write real characters and don't worry about them being specific, gender specific in some way,
but
having a female book writer really, you know,
we could have some gut checks of, like, wait a minute, is this something that would actually happen in, like, a conversation full of girls in high school, and Laura would be like, yes, because they're people. I mean, probably the only thing we're missing if we were going for, like, straight up realism is, from my own memory from high school, people did talk about, like, their outfits and, like, boobs a little more, and, like, so, like, little things like that that are, like, we're totally part of everyday conversation in the same way that, like, dudes walked around slapping each other's junk, like, because it was just weird. High school's gross. But we decided to kind of gloss over that because the audience for this is parents.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The audience, like, The audience for Numbers Nerds is the parents of high schoolers and middle schoolers.
Now, was that theory derived or conclusion derived from the larger cast version, or do you apply it to both?
It's the target market, right? Like, yeah. if just like from a cold, unartistic standpoint, if what we're hoping to do is give a lot of opportunities for like female high school performers who tend to like only be able to compete for like one or two lead roles, otherwise they're in the chorus, whereas the majority of the parts in the show, all but one, are for women actors, which is also the majority of theater departments in high schools. Like, if we're trying to serve that artistic need, the way to do that is have it appeal to an audience of their parents, because that's who comes and sees high school shows.
So
the realization we had was, by the time this like fully catches on, the parents are kind of going to be our age. Like, we're all in our late 20s, early 30s, and, you know, if it takes a few years for something to catch up some momentum, they're going to be within 10 years of our age. So the humor is definitely targeted towards, like, the old millennials, young Gen X kind of population, and a little bit older. Well, you know, not trying to be stale, but just, you know, there's one character... Well, I don't want to spoil it. There's one character who lives entirely of the humor, entirely in, like, more or less the year 2002, in their humor.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah, and...
That's great.
It lands with all of these audiences we've had so far in a way that we're like, is this going to work? I don't know. Yes, it did. Thank goodness.
Yeah, so, in the writing of the show, it's, like, the audience that we're targeting is those parents, but, like, we also want the show to be... something good to chew on for these budding actresses, so and actor. So it's towing that balance between like this is going to be like not boring for the parents and like entertaining for the parents and also like challenging in certain ways for the students.
It
gets something out of it.
It's almost like you guys are writing it at two different levels of point of view. You know, you're needing to satisfy the kids that are watching the show. And also the older generations. Mm-hmm. So it really is tricky in that, you know, you have a certain percentage of the jokes that the kids are going to get, maybe the adults aren't going to get, and vice versa. So that's that's tricky. That's tough.
Yeah.
That really is. Now, what types of... Are there any particular types of musical stylings that you...
Well,
you work in Numbers Nerds?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so part of the original... kind of vision for the show that Larry had was that it would be a poppy rock score, like very, very contemporary musical theater, like, you know, he cited it should sound like a combination of Alan Menken and Mark Shaman and, you know, those kinds of things, maybe a little bit of Jonathan Larson,
sure,
sort of sprinkled in, you know. And I saw that on the posting, I was like, you know, that's my jam. That'll be fun. So it's going to be a lot of that. It's a lot of just that fun.
It's pop rock.
Upbeat
fun.
Pop rock style. But we like to throw a little twist in, you know, here and there. Like something that's going to surprise the audience either. You know, just not be stale, hopefully. Not be something that they've... It'll be something that's familiar, but not something that's tired, hopefully.
Yeah, like, one song to listen for is called The Pressure Is On. And this is something that... It's the competition song. We come to it in a few different variations over the course of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And the, like, fundamental verb behind it is, like, high-stakes computing of math, right? It's like, that's the verb that is happening musically in the show. So David created this, like... really cool song. I love it. It's like really cool, like sonic landscape that's going on during the show. That is
really happy with that.
Something I've not heard in a musical before, but it's got this like weird atonal like pattern happening in it that somehow has this
tritones.
Like, yeah, some yeah. Got the Devil's interval.
I'm picturing like when I used to watch or when I watch a lot of old movies, and you'd have the big giant computer in the background, and we'd be going beep 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 boop boop beep beep. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's, like it's definitely inspired by that kind of thing, you know. And
that's my ringtone, by the way. I'm sorry, go on.
But then, like, there's also this high stakes competition environment, so it'll morph into something which, on the score, I wrote as sports rock.
Yeah. Ah.
So
that's
like,
right. That's
picture,
my favorite
like,
note
you know,
on the score.
Like the NBA theme song kind of thing, you know, like, so like it's like going into different lane. And surprisingly, it's like one of my favorite things that we've done. I think it like works out really well. It's fun, you know.
Was it a big challenge for you? Is that why, or did it just come really naturally and was just super fun to write?
I'll tell you as an observer, because I sent this like set of lyrics to David without knowing what the music was going to be. And I like had a vague sense that we wanted it to feel a little, I didn't use the term sports rocky, but I think it was like, we were talking about the Final Countdown.
Yeah,
as
yeah,
like
yeah.
One of our inspirations.
Oh my gosh.
For it. Like, yeah, like, just epic. Like, Rocky's gonna win. Like, that kind of thing. Or is he gonna win?
Cool.
And I said that to David, and it was one of the fastest turnarounds we've had for music, where we weren't able to be in the same room for this one. And he's like, he sent back an email to something like, I know this is weird, but listen to the whole thing.
Yeah,
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, it really did. It came out like it was just. I mean, his lyrics were like, I got the lyrics and they were. They just suggested like you said, it needed to be like tense like that, and there was a certain amount that should be just like sort of spoken like in a tense way. And it's like,
sure.
I'm not going to set those lyrics. I'm not going to write a melody to that. We're just going to do this kind of like vamp underneath to try to amp up the tension, and I was sort of just plunking around, and I was like, ooh, like that's a weird, like, oh, they can't see the gesture I'm making and the face I'm making, but it's a like, ooh, like that's weird sounding.
Yeah, I should say that the meter of this I sent him is probably the most broken meter of a song we have ever done.
Yeah,
like the rhythm of it's like da 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 da. It's weird, and David is like, oh yeah, got it, math. Rubik's cubed it and just like pulled something out. Like, oh,
yeah,
I love it.
That's a lot of upbeat. That's a lot of upbeat going on.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I sort of had this ulterior motive of like a musical idea that I've had since I was like 12. And I was like, when I used to want to write video game music when I was a kid, and like I had this kind of video game soundtrack song that I came up with years ago, and the score progression, and I was like, this might be the time.
Was that the
No. That was actually you came up with that. Like that was, you were like, I kinda had this in my head. I was like, great, I'll use that.
Beautiful. But I dabble with melody.
Yeah, and then, you know, I say, well, that lyric's bad. Why don't we do this lyric instead?
Right.
So we have back and forth. But it was like, so this is bad, people haven't heard it, but we don't know what we're
doing. It's kind of exciting, though. Like, here, look, see the show, then you'll recognize these pieces and you can be in the know.
Yeah,
the
exactly. Yeah.
Exactly, right?
So it goes back in between this, like, weird atonal thing and then this, like, computer game sports rock sort of chord progression that I had made up like 15 years ago or so, whenever.
I like to hope that the like archetype of a high school music director that I have from my like hometown of Richfield, Minnesota is this wonderful woman who is named Donna. She was as old as the city. I think she was always there, and I think she's still there. And she could show up, and you could put any piece of music in front of her, and she'd be a little annoyed at it, and then she'd play it perfectly. And like that was the accompanist for every audition in my high school. Mm-hmm. And like she also played organ at the church. I like to think this is one of them we'd put in front of someone like that, and be like, "Damn it!" And then would start to play it just because it's like weird. But then you get into the groove.
Yeah. I should also give it a shout out to Nick Sula, who wrote our orchestrations, which I heard for the first time at rehearsal the other day. And they are, I was worried because I was like, I have a sound in my head and I wasn't, I wasn't in contact with him while he was working on the orchestrations because it was happening in Chicago and everything. And I was like, are they going to be right? And he just nailed it. Like they're awesome. It sounds like exactly like what I had in my head. The style, you know, for instance, of the sports rock, I'm like, yes, it's right on. It's like so, cheesy and wonderful, and like, and the musicians that we have are kicking ass, the drummer and bassist, and our music director Dylan, who also did the additional music, or he's the conductor.
Yeah.
So the orchestration really like take it up a notch, I think. So I'm really excited about that.
It was nice to be surprised by that too. That's something you probably would have a bit more of a hand in, but just the way it all kind of came together.
Yeah, you're like a pen in the hand, ready to take notes on all the. That must have been like a hallelujah moment for you guys. Mm-hmm. Like chills. Like this that you've been working on so hard, and you bring in the orchestrator, and they make beautiful music out of it. You guys just must have been like.
Oh yeah,
it's really nice.
That is terrific. Now, who is out of your entire creative team, cast, crew? Who is the biggest numbers nerd in real life?
Well, maybe Larry, because he was a
CPA for a very long time.
His main career.
It might also be me.
Also, Alex.
Just like as a science major, a lot of the math.
Laura is pointing at you.
Oh, Laura's pointing. Okay, cool. Got some background in there. Yeah.
Alex is a nerd.
I am a nerd.
He's got the
and
glasses
like,
to prove it.
I do glasses to prove it. We all wear glasses, to be clear. But I don't know. It's something that I've always really loved, and a chance to have a character like the character of Melissa, who, if there's a lead, it's her.
Yeah.
But it really is an ensemble show.
And she sings Melissa's First Theorem.
That's right.
We talked about
it. Which is a song, like, she has this kind of, like, this feeling of her own, or this dream of kind of her own ascendancy, her own, like, coming in to her own as a mathematical genius and, like, being one of the greats. It's not a spoiler. You find it up pretty early in the show. It's literally her first line is, this is the page in my biography where scholars will say it all started. Right? That's how she opens. So
that's a great line, Laura. Excellent line. She's smiling.
She's smiling because it's my lyric.
Whoops, sorry.
No, we all have a hand in all parts of it. Like, that's the kind of exciting part. Like, I'm credited as lyrics, David's credited as music, Laura's credited as book, but we also sit in a room and we're like, David, like you said, we'll be like, yo, that lyric's bad. We'll be like, oh, I know. Come on.
It's a total alchemy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't understand. Like, they say, how do you write this as a team, and the roles really do blur.
Mm, yes.
They blur together, and it has to work that way. You have to help each other. And also, one of the things that I've noticed is that with each musical that I've only written two, but both of them had their own formula of creation. Mm-hmm. Like in one, I wrote a giant play, and then we turned it into a musical. And the book really led the music. Now, the other one that I've written, the music leads the book.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and you kind of have to take a little while to figure that out, to figure that formula out. Do you guys feel that way when you're working on projects?
I mean, every product has been a little bit different.
Right.
For example, Haymarket was the weirdest way we've ever approached a show, where, like, I spent 2 years researching it, like, in my spare time. And then got a chance to go live in Berlin for about 4 months because my wife had to. My wife's a PhD student of religion at the University of Chicago.
Interesting.
And she needed to learn German, and also there was a scholar there she really wanted to work with. And I hated my job, so I was like, you know what? I'm coming with you. We're doing this.
Right.
But I was able to like sit down and just basically write the whole thing, and over the course of a few months, and then like emailed it to David. It was like, hey, here's a whole musical, you think you could write the music? He's like, what? And a lot changed from that. Like, that was not by any means the final draft, but that was like
change,
that was one way of doing it. And then this, we've like mostly been in the room together being like, what's our moment here that we're elevating, what isn't? Every time it's different.
Yeah, and every show, not every show, but like a lot of the shows that we've worked on have had different iterations of writers. So there's been the three of us. We also have another writing partner, Brendan, who's written a couple shows with us. Mm-hmm.
One of the quickest wits when it comes to like writing dialogue.
That's always good for dialogue.
He's so delightful. And we'll just like have exactly the right way to land when it comes to a joke that let's leave the rest of the room in stitches.
That's tough to do.
Yes.
As well. I mean, I've known people who were funny in a room, but they can't write a joke to save their life. Right. I mean, you know, like, you're so funny, you know, tell me, and they just can't do it. Now, you're talking a lot about development, and Underscore Theater Company develops a lot of new work. What is the best part of being involved with that process?
Gosh, I mean, the best part is you get to...
Opening night.
Opening night is one of the best or worst, because sometimes you didn't do what you wanted to do. Sometimes you fail. And sometimes you get to opening night, you're like, oh, man, if we had one more week, this thing could have been perfect. And as it is, it's garbage. You know, like, you just walk away, and you're like, oh, no, it's fine. But we work with a lot of authors, and we have so many drafts of shows that come our way, and the opportunity to look at something and see its potential, and then working with authors is a beautiful thing, because you find someone whose biography is incredibly different from yours, but you are reaching towards this incredibly specific goal that very few people in the world share. Like, there's not that many people in the grand scheme who are, like, trying to write a musical, even when compared to, like, people who are trying to write a book or, like, want to write a poem. You know what I mean? Like, it's a narrow subset of people, and having that drive is a rare thing, and meeting others who feel that way, it makes you better as an artist, it makes them better as an artist, and you can create this kind of... It is alchemy. The word you used earlier, I think, is exactly right.
Thank you.
And it is... I guess I would say synergy if I wanted to sound stale. But, like, it's a beautiful thing that every time is very different.
And you learn something new every single time with meeting different people and collaborating with different styles of people that work in different styles.
And you learn more about what you have to ask for. Like, as producers, we now know that, like, we want to put deadlines on contracts in a way we've not always had to, depending on the show we worked with.
Sure.
And then we learn that as authors, like, we know what it's like to be a producer, and we sympathize very dearly with, like, Larry, who's got not just, like, us to wrangle, but also a cast and a design team and a creative team and musicians, and, like, he's got to run all of them, and, like, maybe we're not the most important people in the room. Like, we went to tech today and we're like, we're here, everyone. They're like, fine. We're teching. Like, oh, cool. Yeah.
They're like, but you didn't see us in that room, like, last year when we were trying to make it all happen.
Right.
And
then you realize, like, you know what? Actually, our work is done.
Our work is done. Exactly. Yeah. If you need a new line, just email me. Text me or whatever. I'll shoot you a new line. Now, you guys at Underscore, you have an open submission policy, and I like what you have here on your webpage. It says, we don't select shows just because they are easy, marketable, safe, or fully formed. We select shows based on their artistic merit, originality, daring, and most of all, their potential. And that's terrific. It's so nice to read something like that, as opposed to, we're only accepting shows for this demographic.
Right.
And so many, there are a lot of New York-based theater companies, they've got, I don't want to say an agenda, they have a mission to produce a certain kind of show, and that may change year to year. And that's, sometimes it's a little disappointing if you're a writer. You guys, I'm sure, have gone through it too.
Oh, yeah.
To have this sort of, like, open-mindedness and willingness to see everything or read everything that you get, that's a wonderful, wonderful quality and very, very rare.
Thank you.
And usually,
David,
it's...
I think you wrote that copy, actually, on the website.
Yeah.
And it's very true. We have an ensemble that is just a group of artists who really jive mentally with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And we read every submission that we have, and we sit down for a season selection every year, and we just have an honest conversation of, like, this has a really good idea behind it, but it needs room to grow. Do you think it would be better to offer it a workshop or better to offer it a production? And the question is never, like, is this going to sell?
Right.
Because we're very much a nonprofit that is heartily accepting donations, but we're very much a nonprofit in that we exist as a mission-based organization, and our mission is not to enrich ourselves. David, Laura, and I, and the rest of the Underscore staff and board and ensemble are all volunteers. and we don't have full-time gigs doing this. We all have full-time jobs, and we then do this in Chicago. We do it because we realized there wasn't anyone doing new musicals. We did a few of our own and realized we could do it in a way that was inexpensive but still had polish and still had that production value.
Sure.
So, you know, your average Nymph show costs something like $80,000 to produce, which for a commercial show is cheap.
Oh, yeah, in New York, for sure.
But we do it in Chicago for, like, a fully staged, large cast, band musical for under 30. And that's for a long run that could extend. And even that feels expensive. Mm-hmm. Like, we've been able to do it for cheaper because it's not about getting a property and throwing all the money you can at it because you're hoping that investment's going to pay off later and you have the sunk cost fallacy and all that. It's about working with artists, nurturing their work, and making the world of musical theater, and especially Chicago musical theater, better. We want to make Chicago an exporter rather than importer of musicals, which is, you know, a little audacious.
Not really. I think Chicago is a total incubator theater city.
For everything but musicals so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, there are one-off new musicals done by some of the major or mid-sized companies every couple of years. Last year, there were two total entries in the new musicals category for the Lookwell Awards, the Jeff Awards.
Really?
And one of them was ours, and the other one was Northlight, right?
Northlight, yeah.
But they, like, it's rare.
Very, very, very rarely, if ever, do you have a musical that plays in Chicago and is then published and done by other regional theaters. It might play in Chicago and then, by some happenstance, transfer to New York, after which it will.
Yeah,
it
so
will
we
go
were
on
a
way
station there, but we weren't like the net, we weren't the exporter of it, right? We were, you know, just, it was here for a minute. Like, the, you know, Big Fish had a Broadway, pre-Broadway tryout in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And
those are shows that are already destined to go to, right, to Broadway or off.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Wow. Well, I stand corrected. I thought that's interesting to hear that perspective, because perhaps a lot of other people may think the way I have the opinion that I had, that Chicago is bolstering a creative environment for new material, mm-hmm, in the musical category, and you guys are doing this. So that's absolutely terrific.
Yeah, and I will say, since we started, that has changed a little bit. Like, when we arrived, the theater building had just closed, which had been a big hotspot for new musical development. And they had this thing called the Stages Festival, where they would do 8 new musicals every summer, 4 of which had full staging, 4 of which were workshops. And that went away when the organization, unfortunately, folded and they had to sell their assets. It was very sad. And there was a fund created for developing new musicals. There's a $1 million fund that went to Chicago Shakespeare Theater, which is a very good custodian for a trust, but that funding does not usually make it to, like, creators at the storefront level. These are more developing things like the Key Brothers' Christmas Carol or that sort of work. Other theater companies have emerged to start to nurture that mission. There is... Okay, let's remove this part, because I'm going to blank on what the company's name is.
Oh, no, that's okay. That's fine. Well, you guys do something great every year, and it's called the Chicago Music Theater Festival.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Welcome to our personal dream and nightmare.
Oh my god!
You know, so I mean, we're all volunteers who run a theater company, and we realized that we needed to find ways of showcasing a lot more artists at once, because at the pace we can do it, like 2 main stage shows a year and a couple of workshops, just isn't enough for the amount of writers who are out there who really deserve to have their work showcased or have an opportunity to produce themselves at a very low cost way. So we came up with a model where Underscore pays for the space rental, the light rental, the sound equipment, and like festival-wide PR and marketing. And we're able to do that because we have really good relationships around town. We can get huge ad breaks and we can get good deals on spaces. So we could hold some applications to be a part of it so we can like vet it with a jury and then narrow it down to anywhere between 8 and 12 new musicals every year. So this year is going to be our fourth. And it actually will not be in the summer this year. It's going to be next February. We wanted to coincide with Chicago's Theater Week, which is they created this like, you know how Prime Day is a fake holiday created to sell things on Amazon Prime? Theater Week is a fake holiday created by the like, Chicago Theaters.
Or Emoji Day that was like 2 or 3 days ago.
Is yeah. that real? I didn't even hear about yeah. that.
Probably coincided for the Emoji movie.
You are almost certainly yeah. right. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. So Theater Week was created because it was the deadest 2 weeks in theater ticket sales citywide. It was like the middle 2 weeks of February. Like something about how soul-crushing the world is that time of year in Chicago made people not want to go outside and see a play. So they created Theater Week where all the theaters in town offer discounts. There's like special restaurant partnerships. There's like series just for Theater Week you can buy. And so we wanted to bring our festival a little bit more into the Chicago consciousness by being a part of that in a really big way.
Right.
So we'll have a good chunk of shows. We're not ready to announce what they are just yet.
That's fine.
But those will be happening in February right over the...
Well, I'm sure that you'll keep everybody posted on your Facebook page.
You better believe it.
Yes,
right, and as well as your website. So, speaking of that, why don't you guys go ahead and give me your media information? Do you have that available?
Yes, well, okay. I have my personal website, which is davidkornfeld.com.
Cool.
And that is the hub for everything, but I'm also on... Recently joined the Twitter world and the Instagram.
Yeah, we're kind of Luddites. Like,
I was kicking and screaming, you know.
Absolutely.
Into the 21st century.
I downloaded Instagram for the first time like a week ago because my wife insisted on it. She's like, I am taking pictures of our dog and you have to see them. Fine, you're right, I will. That's a good point. So that is why I have Instagram.
So you're on Instagram to see the pictures of your dog that your wife
gave you. Absolutely, yes. Luddite.
And I'm there partly because people kept taking pictures of me and I need to.
Well, he's got this beautiful
sure
top knot. I would take a picture
too. be able to see what's out there.
You have to have your hair down tonight at the premiere, just so that we can see what
he
it looks
like.
He
looks so good with his hair down. It is ridiculous. The envy I have for this is ridiculous.
Well, it's my dream to play Jesus in Reefer Madness. So that's my, you know,
oh,
my dream role.
Perfect
so.
For that day.
If I was ever to become an actor, that
yeah.
would be my
role. Let's make that happen.
Yes, indeed. But media info, all of our info is at _theater.org. That's the word _, the word theater spelled the fancy way, R-E.
R-E, good.
.org.
Can clarify that.
Then we have the Numbers Nerds website is
Numbers Nerds
the musical.
TheMusical.com.
Thank you.
Yep.
And it's also on Facebook at Numbers Nerds.
Yeah, just search Numbers Nerds. If you look at the title treatment, it looks like there's a 3 in for one of the E's. Don't worry about that when you're searching for it. It's just Numbers Nerds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like if it comes up on Yahoo or Google or something like that.
Yeah, just type in the words Numbers and Nerds. It'll be easier. Yeah, just you might be confused if you see like the logo and you're like, well, is it N3RDS? No, it's just Nerds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you clarified
yeah.
that. any other websites or anything you want to...
Well, our other show, we recently started setting up the website for our other show, Haymarket. Haymarket, is it haymarketmusical.com?
It's haymarketmusical.com.
Yeah.
There we have pictures from the show, some reviews, some info on awards, and some lovely black and white, high contrast headshots of David and I, alongside some... effusive bios.
Yes.
we writers, we don't get to take those fabulous headshots like we should, right?
Yes.
I mean, mine is probably about a good 15 years old and includes none of this gray,
oh,
but
yeah,
I'm still going to put it on there.
I have short hair in my headshot.
Right. Do you know the playwright Ike Holter?
I do, yeah.
Well, yeah. His headshot, I've made fun of him for this a few times, but his headshot is him, like, throwing his head back in laughter with his full beard and just, like, so, like, vivacious that I've never seen a playwright who has like that much movement and energy and story in their own photo. And it's like, I admire his writing so much. And I'm like, how did you even manage to like mirror the things I like about your writing in your damn headshot? Like, come on.
I know. So some writers are, they're just so, it's like such big personalities. Like there's a writer out here named Max Vernon who wrote a musical called The View Upstairs, which was terrific and is going to be going, you know, did you see it?
I did.
Yeah. Oh, he's a great guy. Actually, they submitted that to Pride Films and Plays for a competition, and I was one of the readers on it.
Oh, nice. Didn't it premiere there originally, like a few years ago?
They always do readings of all of their top five finalists, and his was a top five finalist. Oh,
cool.
And I gave him all perfect scores, but like he is just so, like he's like, okay, you're a writer. You're a writer because this just all says writer. Some of us just can't do that, right? So you just keep going with that, David. You just be you do whatever you want with your hair. Is there anything that you guys want to talk about or promote before we wrap up?
If you know any high school drama teachers or remember yours and love them dearly, tell them about Numbers Nerds.
Absolutely.
I say that partly because I earn money when you tell them about Numbers Nerds, but also because I think it's important that we give more roles to women in high school, because a lot of actors emerge from high school undertrained when they are women and overtrained when they are men because of the number of leading roles that are available.
Oh, wow.
Or just prepared to audition for the chorus. And we see a lot of auditioners with underscore, hundreds and hundreds every year.
I'm sure.
You can tell from the history of roles on people's resume, and then when you see them perform, that they could be more trained, or they could have done a lot more even by this early moment in their career had they had the opportunity to do so. And we try to give those actors a chance to shine.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to cast a lot of new folks in every show that we do rather than just working with the same recurring cast of characters. But giving folks that opportunity really early on is, I think, huge and important. And
sure.
Then I just want to have different shows be performed at high schools because... Mm-hmm. What was that stupid joke I made the other day? Like, raises more red flags than a middle school production of Les Miserables. Like, there's just too many... I'm determined for that to become an iconic phrase. There's just too many remounts of the same five shows in high schools. And high schools is where your passion for theater tends to start.
Absolutely.
Unless you're born into a performing family, you find a new family in high school theater.
Right.
And the same way that a lot of instrumentalists find it in band, it's... an art that, like, you know, hooks you behind the navel and pulls you in. And if you're able to dig into something that someone else hasn't dug into before on, like, a national level, or there's not, like, you know, you can't Google the YouTube video of someone being Mama Rose.
Right.
Or you can for this one, but you can't tell which one is supposed to be the definitive. You get to create that. You get to have that empowerment as an actor.
Yeah.
I think advocating for new works at dramatic... in dramatic departments at like the high school and middle school level is incredibly important.
And along those lines, like if this works out well, we will do more. You know, there's like more where this came from, and so
when it works out well,
yes,
that's
when it works out. When it works out,
and you know, we'd like nothing better than to continue doing that and cultivating more opportunities for young aspiring theater artists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on those wonderfully lovely notes that you guys just issued and given schools their theatrical mission statements, pretty much, we'll wrap up. I mean, that was just so beautiful. I can't think of a better place to wrap up the show. So, gentlemen, thank you. You were both so informative, and I learned so much, and you're both very, very charming, and... break a leg tonight at the premiere of Numbers Nerds.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Thank
you.
Pleasure to be here.
Oh.
So much for having us.
Oh, it's my pleasure entirely. Now, at the end of each show, I like to give shout-outs to current productions that I think are worth a recommendation. On tonight's show, I'm doing something I've only done once before and giving a blind recommendation to Numbers Nerds. And the reason for this is because I've been very impressed with this writing team's work. And I believe this is... directing and also producing, so I haven't really seen them as writers, but I bet they're just
awesome. This year I was able to catch a production of My Name is Annie King, which was put on by Underscore, and I believe I just heard was directed by Alex. Mm-hmm. And I'm very impressed by that. And I love this show. It had a lot of heart, and it was beautifully directed. I love the set. The set was great. The music was lovely. And
I finally found out who Annie King was at the very end.
and it wasn't given away. I was like, I was really surprised. It was wonderful.
Yes.
Underscore also produced my musical co-writer, Leo Schwartz's musical, Pen, that he wrote with one of his other co-writers, D.C. Cathro, who is a very good friend of mine, last year. And was it last year?
Yeah, it's last year's Musical Theater Festival.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. Okay. And it was terrific. And overall, the show just feels totally right up my alley. It feels like it's, you know, again, I haven't watched or listened to much because of the fact that I want to be surprised tonight. And it just feels like it's a story about underdogs who learn to work together and conquer their own part of the world. And that's so inspiring to me. I'm one of those people, I don't cry at a theater if something's sad. I cry if something is inspirational or a character gets their release or they finally get what they deserve in a good way. That makes me cry. That's edifying and I love that. So, anyways, you guys go to nymph.org for tickets and information, or you can also go to numbersnerdsthemusical.com. Don't be afraid of the three when you look for it. And also, I want to repeat, please make sure that you go get tickets right away because these shows sell out really, really fast. So, there we go. Well, folks, the proverbial 11 o'clock number has been sung and the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain. I'd like to thank my guests, the uber-talented music writing team of Numbers Nerds, lyricist Alex Higgenhauser and composer David Kornfeld. You can find your program at Is Your Ticket at facebook.com/yourprogramisyourticket. I'm on Twitter at programticket. The website is yourprogramisyourticket.com, and I'm on iTunes, so go there, listen to the shows. Rate me, write me a review. I'm a writer, and as these guys can attest, we get reviewed all the time. You've got to be thick-skinned, and I am. Folks, take a little time to see a show this week, particularly at Nymph and particularly Numbers Nerds. And don't forget to give a smaller show some love. There's a lot of theater gems out there. Until our next episode, good night, theater people, and curtain.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.